6 months until Election Day in the U.S. Democrat Joe Biden and Republican Donald Trump are the front runners. But what about third party candidate RFK Jr.? Newsmax contributor Mercedes Schlapp and podcaster and former gubernatorial candidate Tudor Dixon weigh in. Columbia University chaplain Father Roger Landry shares his thoughts on those violent pro-Palestinian demonstrations on his campus and around the country. And radio host and author Todd Starnes talks to us about his new book, Twilight's Last Gleaming. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. If you'd like to comment on tonight's show, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo. We're dedicating this entire show to the memory of a dear member of our world over team, Christina Kelly Colliffe, who we lost this week. I'll tell you more about Christina later in the show. But let's start with this election season. The 2024 election campaign is in full swing despite Donald Trump's ongoing trials and President Biden contending with inflation and protests all over the country. And what of that independent challenge from Robert F. Kennedy Jr.? Here with analysis, I'm joined by Newsmax contributor Mercedes Schlapp and podcaster and former GOP nominee for governor of Michigan, Tudor Dixon. Thank you both for being here. Ladies, there's that Yahoo YouGov poll showing Republican Donald Trump is losing his slim lead over Joe Biden. Now, some say this is due to ongoing legal troubles. The presumptive nominees appear to be tied at 44% going into the November election. That's down from when Trump had a 46% lead. Mercy, what does that tell you? Does it signal declining support or just the normal wax and wane of a political
season? Well, first of all, Raymond, thank you for having me on the show. And I do want to pray for Christina's family. She was an incredible, incredible woman. Yeah. So prayers to her family and to your team as well. But just I think it's important to understand here that when you're looking at the swing states like Pennsylvania, like Nevada, North Carolina, Georgia, Arizona, President Trump is doing significantly better than Joe Biden. Now, of course, I move forward with caution on this because you'd like to see President Trump up by 7 points or 8 points and not a slim margin like 2 or 3 points.
Yeah, he's in the margin of error, even in the state polls.
Yes. And so that is problematic for President Trump, especially as we know Biden has a big war chest. And it has a very strong grassroots organization at this point in time. But I will say, when you're looking at the issues like the economy, where people cannot afford to live in this country right now, when you're looking at the chaos happening on our college campuses, when you're looking at the chaos at the border with illegal immigrants crossing the southern border on a daily basis, hundreds of thousands of them, this is very problematic for Joe Biden, and it's why you're seeing this trend, a move in favor of Donald Trump.
Tudor, given the fact that Trump could be the first convicted nominee to lead a major ticket in the United States, is it surprising that his support remains so strong? I mean, as Mercy said, when you look at those state numbers, they're more impressive, frankly, than the overall percentage nationwide.
No, I don't think it's surprising at all, because I think everybody sees these trials for what they are. This is election interference. This is another political party trying to get rid of their opponent. And I think that's actually increasing his support. But I think it's also increasing his support for a couple of other reasons. You have the media every single day having to talk about Donald Trump, and yet Donald Trump isn't able to go out and campaign. So they don't have statements from him. They can't pick on him. They can't say, oh, he said this and it's bananas. They can just talk about him, and people see him sitting there as a victim of the Democrat Party in those trials every day, and it actually makes him look pretty darn good.
A quick question to both of you before I get to some of these issues that are bubbling out. When you look at these men, when you just look at them and the crowds that are turning out for Donald Trump, Mercy, and he's kind of running this, it's almost like a shadow campaign because he's stuck in the courtroom in New York for most of the time. Yesterday, he did, two Michigan and Wisconsin on the same day. state because it's his only open day during the week to hold a rally. Given that, contrast it with what you see from Joe Biden, where the crowds are tiny, and we have to say his cognitive, his physical state is not
right.
What it was even a few years ago.
No, clearly, I think that even Democrats are very concerned of the cognitive decline of Joe Biden. And what you're seeing, especially, and what's appearing in these polls, is that the Republicans are unifying around Donald Trump. There's more enthusiasm for Donald Trump as opposed to Joe Biden, where the Democrats are not unifying as quickly as the Republicans are. The big question will be, will Nikki Haley's supporters come on board? That's important. You need to have a strong Republican number coming out of these critical states, and then add to that the coalition of Latino voters, of Black voters, of women voters, which, as we're seeing in the polls, they are shifting towards Donald Trump. With that being said, Biden is having a very difficult time motivating the young voters. Why? Because of this issue with the Hamas-Israeli conflict, and the young voters are not connecting with Joe Biden, and the stress that many of the minority communities are feeling because of the failed Bidenomic policies.
Tudor, I want to get to this, and I'm going to throw that to you, the Biden's first comments on this, these protests. But your thoughts on the condition of Joe Biden right now and what impact that might have. I mean, I'm amazed that he's not down 10 points, given that he has such difficulty even communicating.
Again, they keep him out of the spotlight a lot of the time. But even the speech that you're talking about, you can mm-hmm. see that he gets confused. He's obvious. I mean, either he hasn't read it or he forgot that he read it because he reads it wrong. He gets confused in many spots. And like you said, this is 3 minutes that he's struggling. And so, yes, I think it definitely hurts him. I think the Democrats know it hurts him. But they are very aligned when they want to be. And they pretty much just tell their people, this is what you're going to do. You have to do it. They don't know how to handle this situation on college campuses. It was very evident in Michigan when the primary came along and you saw MSU and you saw U of M vote uncommitted. That is a concern for them, and that is going to be their big issue come November.
Okay, this is President Biden speaking out today. A bit of his 3 minute and change address. Watch.
This isn't a moment for politics. It's a moment for clarity. So let me be clear. Peaceful protest in America. Violent protest is not protected. Peaceful protest is. It's against the law when violence occurs. Destroying property is not a peaceful protest. Thank you.
Mr. President, do you think the National Guard should intervene?
No.
Mr. President, do you agree?
What do you make of that, Tudor? Do you think the National Guard should intervene? No. He doesn't even turn around. Your reaction.
My reaction is that I see this and I say, this is not a presidential speech. This is not somebody who's taking charge of the situation. I mean, the way they talk about what happened on January 6th, and we see people going into property, zip tying the door shut, locking people inside overnight, and he says nothing about it. He doesn't think there should be any intervention. We know that money has gone to these protesters through Act Blue. What exactly is going on with the Democrat Party? Do they not want to talk about it? Because if it were investigated, it would lead right back to them and potentially link them to a terrorist organization. All of it is very bad because we know they're saying that they're with Hamas. We know these people on campus have said that they've chanted death to America. It all looks very bad for Democrats. And the fact that they are not asking the FBI to come in and investigate where the funds are coming from, where all of these placards and signs are coming from that are the same across multiple different college campuses, why are they not doing that? That makes it look very bad for Joe Biden.
Mercy, I spoke to a SWAT team member who broke up some of these encampments at a particular college. And right. I said, what do you think is driving this? We know they're outside funders. They're well-seasoned protest activists who are there guiding, indeed giving instruction to these students who are not the majority of the people in these encampments. He said he thought this was a dry run for November or after the election, that this is an activist network of anarchists, if you will, lighting up their network and testing the police, the public, and the prosecutors. Your thoughts?
Yeah, we've seen this before. Occupy Wall Street, for example. We saw this during the summer of 2020, the presidential election, when it was Antifa and Black Lives Matter basically rioting in the cities. This is not a surprise. Okay, we're seeing outside consultants. Yes, you can become a consultant here, get paid $300 a day to organize these students, radicalize and indoctrinate these students to believe the Hamas terrorists. Let's remember, it is the Hamas spokesperson that is speaking on behalf of all these, of many of these protesters, saying that the Biden administration is violating their rights. I mean, it is pure insanity. And their goal, and the goal of these protesters and these agitators, is to basically demonize Israel. And their message is very clear. It's death to America, death to Israel, and quite frankly, has no role here in the United States, and has gone from anything of being a peaceful protest to vandalism and violence, and really creating fear amongst the Jewish students and faculty on the university campuses.
No, it's wretched to see, and heartbreaker for so many communities and parents who are paying hundreds of thousands of dollars to facilitate this lawless mayhem. Ladies, I want to shift gears and talk politics about this election, particularly the third-party challenge posed by Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and to a lesser extent, Cornel West. The big question is, can a third party compete in this two-party system? I spoke with RFK last week about his chances of winning. Listen.
Mr. Kennedy, you are polling amazingly at 26% in Michigan. And this has scared not only the Biden campaign, the Trump campaign has started a new website, Radical Effing Kennedy. That's the name of the website.
All we need to do is to get to 33% to win the election. You don't need 50%. It's a three-way race. It's really a five-way race. So all I need is to get to 33%, and I'm close to that in a bunch of states. I'm beating President Trump and President Biden among all young people in this country, everybody under 35 in the five battleground states. I'm beating them among all voters under 45. I'm beating them now in the biggest cohort, which is independent voters.
Tudor, he claims that Biden loses whether he's in the race or not, but only he can beat Trump, he claims. Does that math add up? And what do you make of those Michigan polls?
Look, I think that anytime you have a third party in, it's definitely going to change the dynamics, and timing is everything in politics. Right now, he is playing an interesting game, RFK, because he is not a conservative. He is very progressive. But I think that he is romancing some conservatives with his views on medicine. After COVID, a lot of people got concerned about that, with his views on war. A lot of the things that he's saying is pulling conservatives in, and they're being kind of romanced by the idea, oh, he's a conservative. He's not, but it's dangerous. So I think anybody who says, oh, he's not a threat, it's no big deal, no third party can win, is being very lazy and not doing their job to make sure that their party is in, has everything in order, and they're actually running a strong ground game. And that, I think, is the Republicans' big takeaway from this. Run a ground game, because other people are.
Yeah. Mercy, you know, RFK Jr. told me at one point that he has the most vibrant and widespread ground game, if you will, and ground operation of any of the campaigns. Who do you think he takes votes from, Biden or Trump? Is he eating into Trump's support?
I think he eats more into Biden support than he does Trump support, because, and I think it's important for Catholics, Christians, to understand RFK Jr. is radical on the issue of abortion. So he is not a pro-life. He's not a pro-lifer. He on many of these issues, he is extreme. Where I think that some of these conservatives fall in line with him is that he wants to take down the deep state and really break down the bureaucracy of the government. But that's not going to be enough to pull away from Trump necessarily. Now, on the Biden side, I think it's people who are just really not happy with Joe Biden and his lack of leadership. So I do think I think RFK Jr. pulls more from Biden than from Trump. But again, I find that he has really not a lot of room to go, but he's going to keep going as long as he has money in his pocket to run the campaign.
I asked RFK, Mercy, about his evolution on the issue of abortion. Listen to this, and then let's talk about the abortion issues dynamic in this race. Watch.
You once said abortion should be limited up until viability at 3 months. What changed?
Well, you know, I think that's a rational position, because, you know, I'm a lawyer, and the way that I look at this is that at some point, you know, at some point it's the mother's child, and the baby cannot live outside of the womb.
Right.
But shouldn't that fetus have more rights as it after passes that term of viability? I think there's a strong argument. I just come down in the long run is that we have to leave it to the mother, that she, you know, the mother, her pastor, her doctor, she has to make those choices that I don't feel comfortable saying that a state or some bureaucrat is going to make it for her.
Mercy, look, there's no doubt there's some evolution for a Democrat here, or now an independent. At least he acknowledges the right of the child, even if he won't recognize that child's right in law. Now, your thoughts on where RFK fits into the trajectory of the life issues. Was this a smart dodge or good politics?
Look, I think he knew what your position was on the pro-life issue. And so he was, I think, dancing around the issue by saying, yes, well, you know, there may be somewhat rights for the fetus, but we should be left up to the mother. Look, he's going to follow the Democrat line because there is really no way to win over Democrats unless you are a radical pro-choicer. There's no way. And so I think that Kennedy will pretty much be in line with where the Democrats are on this issue because they can't touch this issue because we know so much of their support comes from the Planned Parenthoods of the world and from so many of those individuals that are, you know, self-proclaimed pro-choice activists. And that's an important coalition. Yeah. For the Democrats, for the Democrat Party. Now, he's running as an independent, but he still needs to court those voters to go his way.
No, he's very thoughtful on the issue. There's no doubt.
Yes.
And personally, he may differ because you've heard some of the utterances where he supported a 15-week ban and then walked it back. So though he's very, I think, thoughtful and has contemplated what this means on policy, there's virtually no difference between where he stands and Joe Biden. I mean, we just have to say
exactly.
That. Former President Donald Trump announced his abortion position on April 8th this way. Listen.
The states will determine by vote or legislation or perhaps both, and whatever they decide must be the law of the land. In this case, the law of the state.
Now, Mercy, the Trump presidency set the stage for overturning Roe v. Wade, which pushed abortion back to the states. Many pro-lifers are disappointed by the president's failure to endorse a national ban. Do they have a point?
Well, I mean, look, this obviously has created friction amongst many of the pro-life activists and where Donald Trump is. But we do know when President Trump was in the Oval Office, he was the most pro-life president of our lifetime. If it wasn't for the justices who he appointed, there would have not been the overturning of Roe v. Wade. So he needs to get credit for that. I actually don't agree with Vice President Pence when he wrote this op-ed piece criticizing Donald Trump on the pro-life issue. I think for Donald Trump, he is looking, he knows the reality. The reality is that you need 60 votes in the Senate to have this national ban. You need a majority in the House to have a national ban. To get that makeup is going to be very, very difficult. And so in his logic, he's saying, well, let the states decide. And it is where after you overturn Roe v. Wade, where this argument is going to end up. At the end of the day, I think these pro-life activists have to ask themselves, who's going to stand up for the unborn? Is it Joe Biden? Is it President Trump? Clearly, the winner on that issue is President Trump.
Look, Susan B. Anthony List, which is an activist group, a pro-life group, they've said they will oppose any presidential candidate that does not support a 15-week ban. Pro-life advocate Lila Rose says Trump's not a pro-life candidate, and he stabbed his supporters in the back. Has he? Or is this political naivete, Mercy Schlapp?
I have to say, I was in the White House when we literally spent days, weeks, months pushing a pro-life legislation, pro-life policies, working on regulations that would limit any funding going to the abortion industry. I mean, President Trump really evolved in the issue, understood, brought in people who survived abortions. And I saw it firsthand. He understands what needs to be done to protect the unborn. I think he is looking through it in a political lens of what can realistically be done, which means from the federal level right now, not too much unless you get 60 votes in the Senate and you win the majority in the House. I think, look, you cannot agree with the president 100% on what when he's talking about the pro-life issue right now, but you cannot deny that President Trump did more to ensure the protection of the unborn than any other president in our lifetime. So I got to say, I understand they want to be critical of him and oppose him, but the reality is they've got to understand, are they going to stick with Joe Biden, who is a radical on the issue of the of abortion, who's in the back pocket of Planned Parenthood and the abortion industry, and push forward gender ideology? Let's talk about that as well. Or President Trump, who will stand on principle and stand to protect the health of the mother and the health of the unborn.
Well, Mercy, you know, we're also dealing with voters here. And I think there are many in the church, and I've seen this, where they want to hold these politicians up to a level where they become the exemplars of the church teaching or the spiritual leaders. They're not. They're politicians. And
exactly.
It is the failure, frankly, to teach these issues in the church over many decades that have gotten you to the point now where you see all these politicians in pretzels trying to message this because the once Catholic block of voters has dissipated. But that's a result of lousy teaching, not because of a politician that just showed up on the scene. But maybe that's a conversation for another day, but it's a good one to be had. I asked RFK Jr. about the majority of abortions today, which, as you know, Mercy, are pharmaceutical abortions. And what the Biden administration just did.
I'm worried about every pharmaceutical drug. I believe in choice. The issue you raised about abortion pill, I think we ought to know what the side effects are, what the risks are, what the benefits, and that everybody should have an informed choice, and we don't have that now.
Would you reverse that rule that Biden just changed, making this available now, these abortion pills, at Walmart, at Target?
No, I would not do that.
Your reaction to that, Mercy, what does that tell you?
Well, again, it tells you that RFK is, he's a Democrat through and through. And obviously for him, he wants to be that viable candidate as opposed to Joe Biden, who, as we know, on that issue, you're not going to see a difference. Where the differences come between Joe Biden and RFK Jr. is that Joe Biden really wants to dismantle the deep state and government institutions. He's opposed to these government mandates when it comes to vaccines. But other than that, there's not a lot of difference between the two men. And so you're basically voting for a Democrat if you're voting for RFK Jr.
Yeah, well, it's clear, Mercy, abortion on demand is going to be the centerpiece of the Biden reelection effort here. I mean, you've got Kamala Harris doing these abortion events all over the country. So is that why you think Donald Trump has politically hedged on this issue a bit, because he's trying to deal with that and what a driver that is to the base of the Democratic and maybe independents in this race?
Look, I think Trump is trying to neutralize the issue, because for the Democrats, the two issues they're going to run on are abortion and that Donald Trump is a threat to democracy. Those are the two issues that the Democrats, they can't run on the economy because people can't afford to pay their bills. Mm-hmm. They can't run on immigration because illegal immigration is out of control at the southern border. They can't run on, peace through strength in the globe, because we're seeing chaos in Russia-Ukraine conflict, which looks like it's never going to end. And then you've got, obviously, what's happening in the Middle East. That doesn't even bring in China, one of our top adversaries.
Yeah.
So you're talking, you're basically, when you're looking at that, it becomes very problematic for the Democrats. So they want to shift the argument to abortion. They want to push fear tactics saying, oh, you're not going to have access to abortion. It is all about, quote unquote, women's reproductive rights. And they played this game in 2022. It worked for them in the midterm elections. They want to play the same playbook again. They want to implement that playbook and see if it works. And quite frankly, I hope Republicans do not run away from this issue. They need to point out the radicalization and the viewpoints of the Democrats, where they're more in line with Russia, North Korea, and China when it comes to this issue of supporting late-term abortions and after the baby's born, and you could kill the baby after the baby's born if it was intended for an abortion. I mean, it's insane. And so that's critical to show that the Democrats are radical on this issue, that we should have some common sense, start with some common sense limits. Of course, if it was up to me, you know, I would say, you know, that we our goal is to have no abortions in this country, that every child can be brought into this world as God intended it. But the reality is, if you can get to that 15-week, that 20-week limit, I think that that's where the majority of Americans are right now.
Mercy, final question. Joe Biden is seeing an erosion in his support from Black America and Hispanic America. Why do you think that's happening? Why is he experiencing that abandonment of his candidacy from these key Democrat demographics?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I mean, and it's part of the Democrat coalition. Yeah. The reality is that when the Democrats are so obsessed with promoting the LGBTQ agenda, promoting puberty blockers to third graders and fourth graders, or supporting the transgender students that are then having the biological males playing in girls' sports and gender ideology, I'm sorry, you're going to lose a lot of Hispanics and a lot of blacks because they, what do they want to do? They want to make sure they can protect their children and protect their families and raise them according to good, solid values. It is not that difficult. And they, I have to say, I've never seen this, I guess I've seen this before, but not to this extent, where the Democrats are so obsessed with sexualizing our children and getting rid of gender. And that in and of itself goes against what so many of us believe in and what so many of us have been taught in our churches. And so I think the Democrats have lost touch. They are beholden to the LGBTQ agenda. They're beholden to the transgenders and really trying to push this gender ideology at the youngest of ages. And I think that the parents are pushing back, especially in the minority communities.
Mercy Schlapp, we'll leave it there. Thank you for being with us. We'll check in with you in the days ahead.
Of course. Thank you.
He's a priest of the Diocese of Fall River and currently serves as Catholic chaplain at Columbia University in New York City. He's been experiencing firsthand the violent pro-Palestinian demonstrations that swamped the campus this week. Here with us to give his thoughts and observations about what's really going on with these protests and the reaction, I'm joined by Father Roger Landry. Great to have you back on the program, Father. The whole country watched police clearing out the encampments in Columbia the other day. New York City officials are warning against the radicalization of the young by these pro-Palestine agitators, including at the Jesuit-run Fordham University. What have you seen at Columbia? Are these predominantly students?
So the arrests 2 days ago of 300 people, 180 were students, 120 were outsiders. And so you've got a little bit of a sense of the percentage there. Three out of five are students. Two out of the five are outside agitators. And the first protest that happened here was 5 days after Hamas's vicious attacks against innocent Jews outside of Gaza. And while I heard, to my shock, the pro-Hamas chants inside Columbia's campus, as soon as I exited the gates, there was a group of pro-Hamas, and I used that precisely, not pro-Palestinian, but pro-Hamas demonstrators. And I got a lot of the flyers that they were passing out. They basically fell into three categories. All three were explicitly communist groups that were justifying what Hamas had done out of this neo-Marxist oppressor versus oppressed ideology that says whatever somebody in the category of oppressed groups wants to do against a so-called oppressor is justified, even killing way more than 1,000 innocent people at a party.
What are the Columbia students telling you?
So the Columbia Catholic students with whom I interact by the hundreds each day are telling me that they are super frustrated with the way that the protests have had a dramatic impact on their life here at campus and no impact on the cause for which they are supposedly protesting. So there's been no change in any policy toward those who are suffering in Gaza, but there's been a big change here. They haven't been able to access their campus. Many of their classes went online. All of their exams now are either virtual or being canceled. And then many of them worry that Colombia's reputation has taken such a nosedive because of this seeming radicalization of everybody that they're quite worried that future employers are going to say, don't want to touch somebody who has graduated from Colombia, even though most Catholic students are just here to work really hard, study, and then to take their education and go try to make a difference.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, look, these protests are ostensibly about the humanitarian situation in Gaza following the October attacks on Israel by Hamas and the Israeli military response. In your estimation, do these demonstrations reflect that humanitarian agenda? Or is it, as New York City officials are now saying, a radicalization of the young and organized from outside of your university and others?
So there was a very interesting Washington Post piece a little over a week ago that showed that there's been great national coordination of all of these protests happening on college campuses. But I would say my experience here, and I visited the encampment every day, and I saw live most of the protests. They were mixed crowds. So some were definite provocateurs, very much in favor of Hamas. Some on the other side were, frankly, sincerely concerned about the humanitarian problems that Gazans are now presently undergoing because of what Hamas continues to try to do in Gaza. And so you do find the whole spectrum there. Likewise, you have a bunch of those who are in the encampments simply because they were upset that certain Columbia students were arrested on April 18th. And out of solidarity, they wanted to go and take their spots. So there are various motivations that bring people there. But what disturbs most of us is there is a sizable percentage of those protesters who are definitely and explicitly in favor of Hamas and the atrocities that Hamas has committed, and definitely anti-Semitic by their language and by their actions.
Yeah, well, and on top of that, you lay in this kind of neo-Marxist communist mindset that is driving so many of the organizers here who are literally caught on cameras giving instruction to the students. Here's how you tie up the door. Put that barricade here. You all go to the other side and place another barricade on the other. I mean, it's instructional. And my question is, you're close to the action. What do you think is driving it? What is the end game here? It's not just to take over a campus building for a night. Something else has to be at play.
Well, there is an instrumentalization of what's going on in Gaza to advance an agenda. And I think that agenda has been in some of Columbia's humanities departments, as well as in other places, which is to deconstruct our present world order, at which the United States is considered the top of that order, and the state of Israel is a satellite of the United States. And so, therefore, to attack what the state of Israel is doing is by straw man trying to attack the world order represented by the United States of America. And this has a long history. When I work with the students here, many of them just don't remember the atrocities that were brought about by the communists and the Marxists over the last century, and to try to let them know that if this neo-Marxism is taking place, it is super dangerous. And for us as Catholics, when I work with the Catholic students, this divide and conquer class warfare that comes from Marx and from Lenin is the exact antithesis of what Jesus Christ himself brought, the Prince of Peace, who tried to gather the tribes of Israel together and wanted to reconcile all things in himself. This divisiveness, this separation, this hatred among classes is exactly what Jesus tried to come to fix. And so to try to get the Catholic students aware of that problem so at least they're inoculated to that intellectual virus, and then to help them help their fellow students recognize that this type of activism coming from without is not only going to harm them as individuals, but can harm the causes that they very much value. What's happening is not that the Gazans are being helped. What's happening is that Columbia students are being hurt. And as Columbia students are being hurt, similar things are happening in other campuses.
No, that's such an important analysis, Father. Brilliant analysis. And the remedy. Look, this isn't only occurring at Columbia. We're seeing it at NYU, at UCLA, the University of Texas at Austin. All of these, or many of them, have a violent edge that has emerged. I mean, I saw a video earlier this morning of a Jewish student trying to walk through the quad and being told, you can't pass through here because you're a Jew. And, you know, and then they've got this surround tactic where they lock arms and kind of encircle these students. I'm sorry. This should not, this has no place, certainly on a campus of higher education, but anywhere in America. And now you hear the chants, death to America, death to Israel. Why do you think we're seeing this vehement anti-American, anti-Semitism, not only at your campus, but all of these campuses nationwide, particularly those with Jewish populations, which is mind-boggling to me?
There are historic reasons for anti-Semitism. In this age in which equity is pushed, a people called the chosen people that most others accept as a chosen people are always going to stick out, and they're going to be the subject of envy. And I think we have to look with credit and say, our Jewish brothers and sisters study hard and they work very hard. And so it's not a surprise that they achieve a lot in life. And sometimes people who don't work quite as hard look at them with envious eyes. And so that's the anti-Semitic piece of this. Mm. I think Marxism has always hated what the United States stands for, which is free enterprise, individual freedoms, etc. And they want to take down that order because they think that it's led to the various injustices in the world. It has led to some injustices. We can't deny that. But at the same time, it's led to some of the greatest human flourishing of all time. But that's resented by the Marxists. The last piece that I'd say with regard to why this is happening now is because we haven't really grounded free speech on our academies. So what is the real purpose of speech and communication? It has to be the truth. If there's not really an active pursuit of the truth, then freedom of speech is unmoored, and it then leads even to using speech to attack groups against whom you're envious.
Well, you know, Father, I always say when religious expression and comedy is verboten, it means the mind has been captured in the soul. And that really is where we are in a lot of these institutions. There's no place for religious expression, and there's no place for authentic humor, because that brings out our humanity. All of it brings out our humanity and our devotion to God who gave us that humanity. And when you take that away, there's very little left but the primal instinct to survive or to beat the other, kill the other, get rid of the other. Before we run out of time, anything good that you're seeing in the chaos and the strife and the mayhem that this last week has brought to your campus and all these campuses across the country?
It's been very edifying to see the students express their great frustration at the bad means chosen, even in favor of what are arguably good ends. Mm. Second, with among the Catholics, I have challenged them to do what Catholics always do in every crisis, which is first to pray as if lives depend on it, because they do, and to exercise acts of charity and to do their studies as good Catholic students, and at the same time to try to be emissaries of the Prince of Peace, who always brings peace, not as a kumbaya moment, but in the form of a cross. The amount of Catholics who have really stepped up to the plate to be able to do that has been edifying. They've asked me to encamp in front of the Blessed Sacrament to be able to implore Jesus while people have been encamping on the grass in Colombia. They've organized their own rosaries, praying to Mary, the Queen of Peace, asking her to help everybody here on campus. We've come to Mass in greater numbers in order at every Mass to hear Jesus say to us, "My peace I give you, my peace I leave you," and bless us to go in peace, glorifying him and bringing his peace to others. They have really stepped forward. One small little thing a couple weeks ago with the leaders, they said, how can we reach out to our Jewish and Muslim fellow students during this time as Passover is coming on up? And they came up with the idea of giving each an olive plant with all the biblical symbolism that's involved there. And so we were able to give those plants yesterday to both Rabbi Yonah Haim at the Columbia Barnard Hillel, as well as Imam Ibad Rahman, who's the Columbia Muslim Life Coordinator. They were very touched, at Catholics, prayerful solidarity, as we, transcending the moment but also incarnating ourselves in the moment, are trying to bring the peace we have received from Christ that our world and our campus very much need and deserve.
Father Roger Landry, always so eloquent. Thank you for coming on, the Catholic chaplain at Columbia University. We thank you for being here. Pray for your safety and hope you'll come back soon.
Thanks so much, Raymond.
My next guest is a best-selling author, nationally syndicated radio host, and during his 15-year career at Fox News Channel, he covered three presidents, as well as some of the biggest cultural and political stories of the decade. He's authored seven books, including his latest, Twilight's Last Gleaming, Can America Be Saved? Please welcome Todd Starnes to the program. Todd, thank you for being here. In the book, you write that since Inauguration Day, the president, Biden, has waged a relentless war on Christians, Jews, American first conservatives, and pro-lifers. Why would he do that? He is an avowed Catholic, and the term most often affixed to him is decency.
Well, there's nothing decent about this presidency. I can tell you that right now, Raymond. And thank you so much for inviting me on today. Look, it's really appalling what this president has done. I think it's pretty clear that he is not running the show at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. The question is, who is running the show? Because whoever that person is, they've got a big problem, especially with people of faith and especially with Catholics. And we have seen this administration really target people who are devout Catholics, going into infiltrating many Catholic parishes, not just in Richmond, Virginia, but around the country, also targeting the pro-life community. It's really amazing when you step back and think about it for a moment, Raymond. There are people that are facing years in prison for taking a knee to pray outside of an abortion clinic. Meanwhile, you've got thousands of pro-Hamas wannabe terrorists that are rampaging American universities, and not a single one of those kids are going to spend any time in jail.
In your book, you relate the radicalization of American public classrooms. You've been documenting this for quite some time, Todd. You say that, quote, educators inspired by President Barack Obama have been fundamentally transforming our nation from the comforts of their classrooms. We are seeing the fruit of that radicalization really across the country in these violent protests at Columbia, Fordham, UCLA. What are we seeing taking place here?
We are watching that radical transformation, as Barack Obama promised, and it's a very dangerous proposition. I write about this extensively in Twilight's Last Gleaming because I believe that our taxpayer-funded school system, that is the engine driving this radical change across America, and that our classrooms have been turned into these indoctrination centers for the left. And we are literally seeing this play out right before our very eyes on many university campuses, both private and taxpayer-funded, where these young people are out there protesting. Many of them have no idea what they're even protesting, but it doesn't matter because thanks to Barack Obama's philosophies, our kids have been dumbed down. And that's all very intentional. And I lay this out in the book that if we really are going to take back America, it can't start in Washington, D.C. It literally has to start in our local towns, our local communities.
In September of 2022, and you mentioned this in a book, President Biden gave a speech in Philadelphia in which he alleged that Donald Trump and MAGA Republicans represent an extremism that threatens the very foundation of our republic. And he went on to say that they're a threat to the country. How did this speech play out, and how was it received by conservative and traditional Americans?
Raymond, I actually start out the book with what I call Darth Brandon at the Temple of Doom and take people back to that speech. And look, I appreciate Joe Biden's honesty, and it's good to know what he thinks about us. It's not all that different than Barack Obama calling us bitter clingers, Hillary Clinton, the basket of deplorables. I am proud to call myself a gun-toting, Bible-clinging son of a Baptist, and I'm not bitter. I believe I'm blessed alongside many of my Catholic brothers and sisters. But it's important for us to understand that what's happening in this country, even what's happening in our university campuses, is really an attack on the foundations of America, this idea that we are one nation under God. So I think ultimately this is all a part of a much bigger picture a much bigger puzzle. We are dealing with an infestation of communism in this country. And I write about this, taking people back to the days of William F. Buckley Jr. and Ronald Reagan, and the modern day start of the conservative movement. And what was the fight back then? Well, they were fighting a communist infestation in Hollywood and many of our university campuses. And now we're dealing with that same story again today in the 21st century.
Todd, you write in the book that, quote, fortunately, parents are fighting back against these activist groups on social media, exposing the radicalization that's happening in public school classrooms. Where are the parents when it comes to these protests, do you think? We've heard very little from them, actually.
Yeah, that's a great question, Raymond. Look, I grew up in the South. I was born and raised in Memphis, Tennessee. And we have a saying in our part of the South, don't be acting the fool in public. And if you do, normally mama would be coming after you with a hickory switch. And that's what I want to know. Where are the moms and dads showing up on campus with the cast iron skillets and the hickory switches? Yeah. And that's a big problem in my estimation. But look, a lot of these kids are super wealthy. They're privileged. They come from, you know, a lot of money and power, and they just really don't care. My book is for the average American citizen, and especially young people. I want them to know about the history of our country, that we are an exceptional country. And the reason why we're an exceptional country is because our founding fathers meant for us to be a nation that was grounded in the Word of God. And I think if we could return to those roots and those values, I think we're going to be able to save America.
I just read an article the other day, and it really speaks to all of this. And this article claims in blaring headlines that murder and crime is down across the country, Todd. Now, that is not the case in your city of Memphis. KWAM News Radio reported this week at least 91 people were shot and 25 killed in shootings across Memphis just in April of this year. What do you think is happening in cities like Memphis, New Orleans? And what do you make of the data being hurled around? I mean, I guess it's an election year, so you should expect this.
We are controlled here in Memphis by radical Democrats, and it's been generational. At least the past 50, 60 years, we've been controlled by Democrats. Most recently, the city elected a George Soros-styled district attorney, and as quick as the police can arrest the bad guys, they're right back out on the streets. But our challenge here in Memphis is most of the kids, most of the people committing the crimes are, in fact, kids. And the mayor's answer to this, believe it or not, Raymond, is more midnight basketball. quite frankly, back when I was growing up, nothing good ever happened after midnight, after 10 o'clock. Mm-hmm. So I think it's time for moms and dads to start behaving like moms and dads and doing their jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, Ronald Reagan said it like this: American greatness does not start in Washington. It starts around the supper table. And we've got to get back to those traditions in this country.
Hmm. Last week, the Biden administration adjusted Title IX, that federal rule meant to protect women in sports, to include biological males who identify as female. Is this supported by the majority of Americans? And is it good politics, Todd? Forget whether there's a group that Biden is trying to play to. Is it good politics?
Yeah, no, not at all. This is insanity. I've got a couple of chapters in the book that deal with this. One's titled Jack and Jill Went Up the Hill and Came Down Gender Neutral. And the other is a fake Associated Press news story set 10 years in the future where the first trans species swimmer was invited to compete against humans in the Ivy League swimming championships, a dolphin who identifies as a human being. Oh. And they all seemed shocked when the dolphin obliterated every human swimming record. It's an absurdity, and it's a denial of basic science and biology. But more than that, Raymond, what we are dealing with here and all of these issues facing our nation, they're all spiritual issues at the root. Mm-hmm. I mean, in essence, this whole transgenderism movement is denying God and saying that God made a mistake. Well, Raymond, I don't know about you, but the God I serve does not make mistakes.
Yeah. You know, that this brings up an interesting question. I just read this article. It was the AP, and it's talking about Catholics, in this case, wanting to return to what they called the old ways. So they're going back to Latin Mass and devotionals that were forgotten. And, you know, they're dressing again when they go to church and they're throwing the guitar, out of the church. They're going back to Gregorian chant. What do you think is happening? There seems to be this interesting trend, Todd, as we see this escalation in the culture of, atheism and secularism. At the same time, you're seeing this reaction of faithful, a counterculture almost rising. You got all these celebrities suddenly announcing that they're being baptized. Russell Brand the other day, Tammy Peterson was received into the Catholic Church. I know a bunch of actors who've converted that haven't, come out and announced it yet. What do you think is happening there?
Well, I think for so long, we went through a period of time where, the church is supposed to influence the culture, right? But I'm afraid it's been the other way around for a long time now. And we are to be salt and light. That's our job as Christians. That's our job as the church, to be salt and light. Unfortunately, a lot of people have been on a sodium-free diet these days. But you're right. Something is changing in the culture right now. And we're seeing this happen, by the way, in real time at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where the protesters, the mob, raised the Palestinian flag. Mm-hmm. And what happened? You had a group of fraternity brothers who went out there, and they were protecting Old Glory. The guys were being pelted with rocks and bottles, and they were throwing water on the young men, and yet they stood their ground. And someone just sent me video a little while ago, even at the University of Mississippi, where the protesters showed up, but even more people showed up and started singing, belting out the Star Spangled Banner to drown out the anti-American rhetoric. So I think you're right. Something is going on here. And I suspect we are on the verge of, dare I say, a patriotic revival here in America.
Twilight's last gleaming. Can America Be Saved by Todd Starnes is available in bookstores everywhere and online. Thank you for being here, Todd.
Thanks a lot, Raymond.
As I mentioned at the start of tonight's show, I have some very sad news to share. A longtime and very dear member of the World Over team, Christina Kelly Califf, passed away last week after a long battle with cancer. Christina was just 52, and she was the beloved wife of Bassam Califf and the devoted mother of 21-year-old Isabella and 20-year-old George. She passed away at MD Anderson Cancer Center in Houston, thankfully surrounded by her family, including her mother, Elizabeth. Christina fought a valiant battle after being diagnosed with lung cancer 2.5 years ago. Nothing was more important to her than her family. And to me and my staff, she was part of our family. And she started working on The World Over and for you nearly 10 years ago. And she did so much to help us shape the program. She was an excellent booker and a segment producer. My senior producer, Christopher Edwards, always said she was his right arm. She was also one of the kindest, most selfless human beings we've ever known. Wise and funny and whip smart. In typical Christina fashion, she left written instructions insisting that her funeral be held after her daughter Isabella's graduation from Boston College later this month. Christina always thought of others and put others first. But I know she so wanted to be at that graduation in person. I know it was one of her goals. And she'll surely be there in spirit. But we are all heartbroken. If I could ask you a little favor of keeping Bassam and Isabella and George Califf and the whole family in your prayers. And may God hold our friend Christina's soul close, and may perpetual light shine upon her. We will miss you, Christina. That's all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, I thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.